Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movie podcast that has been visited by three ghosts. But weirdly, all of them look like the former king of Denmark and have told me to kill my uncle, so that was weird. Anyway, hello, I'm Helen O'Hara, I'm your host, and today we're here to talk a 1-2 punch of Charles Dickens, because this year we have two quasi Christmas Carol adaptations from major studios. We have Spirited on Apple TV and Scrooge, A Christmas Carol on Netflix. Joining me to discuss both is Sarah Cook, marketing manager and Victoriana enthusiast. How are you doing, Sarah?
Yeah, very good. How are you doing?
I am very good. I'm just going to lift the curtain here for people and say that this is the second time we've recorded this because we had problems with the first recording. So apologies to you, first of all, but we're going to try and remember what the heck it was we said, because we had stunning insights the first time. Isn't that right? Like, oh my God, it's probably the greatest podcast in human history.
It was golden, honestly. And it's a shame that it's been lost to the ether. No one will get to hear our beautiful, beautiful in-depth analysis of these two films.
Exactly. But this is just a tribute. So So let's set the scene a little bit for these two films first. Spirited, the Apple film, is a sort of modern day update of A Christmas Carol. So Will Ferrell here plays the ghost of Christmas past. And, you know, every year they go out and they redeem some awful person. But this year he wants a challenge. He wants somebody who is actually going to give them a bit of grief. And he hits on marketing expert Ryan Reynolds' Clint Briggs. And Clint is going to be the big challenge that will kind of really test his mettle and really prove whether the spirit of Christmas can change people for good. It's all directed by Sean Anders, who made Instant Family. And it is also a musical. So we have songs by Ryan Reynolds, Will Ferrell, and the rest of the cast taking us through this modern day version of A Christmas Carol. Now, also out this year on Netflix is director Stephen Donnelly's film Scrooge, A Christmas Carol. Now, this is kind of an animated update of the 1970s, 70-ish, musical by Leslie Bricusse. So it's also a musical. This also has those musical numbers. Scrooge is voiced here by Luke Evans, who thankfully has an amazing voice, which helps. And it is a pretty traditional version of Charles Dickens's Christmas classic. But the animation is a little bit more, you know, modern and up to date than, say, Mickey's Christmas Carol, and has quite a lot of kind of cosmic purple in it. So I guess, look, first of all, Sarah, let's talk about these films. What did you think? Did you have a favourite? How did they both strike you?
I have to be honest, when I first watched Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, the 2022 one with Luke Evans, I did not enjoy it whatsoever. That was 2 weeks ago. And in those 2 weeks, I have become deeply and utterly obsessed with hot Ebenezer Scrooge, aka Luke Evans, and he has taken over my whole TikTok and my life, and I can't stop listening to at least two songs from the soundtrack, which is Tell Me and Later Never Comes, which he sings a ballad duet with the wonderful Jesse Buckley. And as much as I want to be like, God, I hate it, wasn't a good adaptation, and I know it is, that has infiltrated my life. It is now what I'm hyperfixating on right now.
So it's not a good film, but also you're obsessed with it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think I really hate the idea that Ebenezer Scrooge is a hot man, but also kind of love it at the same time. You know, like it ticks some of my boxes. A hot Victorian gentleman sung by Luke Evans, and my critical thinking skills went, and then my hot guy brain went, whoo. And I can recognize that it's a really not a very good adaptation of the novella and of the 1970s film, which is better in so many ways because it's got Albert Finney. But I can also recognize that hot Ebenezer Scrooge is hot Ebenezer Scrooge.
I mean, Albert Finney was not unhot, to be fair, you know. So I guess perhaps there's some kind of precedent there. I mean, of course, Michael Caine played Scrooge as well, famously not an unhot man. Although perhaps past the peak of his hotness at the time when he played Scrooge, with no disrespect to Michael Caine, who remains hotter than any of us will ever be. But yeah, it's a weird thing. Combined with, you know, hot Santa in Violent Night, I'm really not sure how I'm supposed to feel about beloved Christmas characters this year. It's very, very concerning.
It really is. And I was already grappling with Hot Father Christmas with Kurt Russell in The Christmas Chronicles.
Yes.
And now I've got two Hot Father Christmases and a Hot Ebenezer Scrooge. So
very, very upsetting. Well, just again, lay out the soul. What did you think of Spirited in comparison?
Spirited has been one that I thought was going to stay with me longer than it has. And unfortunately, I just thought it was a bit overlong, and the songs, apart from one song, it just so unmemorable. And Will Ferrell really tries his hardest to be a somewhat endearing character, but I found there's a lot of cynicism I think I still have a problem with, and cynical modern jokes that I just didn't feel fitted in with his character necessarily. And I like, they give it a good gung-ho try, which I think is admirable, but it's just a bit forgetful apart from one amazing musical number.
Yeah, no, we should talk about that amazing musical number, because it's Good Afternoon, isn't it? I'm assuming it's Good Afternoon.
It's Good Afternoon. Yeah. The absolute.
Which is absolutely for me the standout song as well. And it's all the better because he's basically, you know, singing fuck you, frankly, as he sings it. And that is his, you know, it is taken from the Charles Dickens book. There is that scene where Scrooge tries to get rid of someone by just repeatedly saying good afternoon, and they just keep not taking the hint. It's like when you're on the phone to an elderly relative and, you know, you have to keep saying, well, yep, well, you know, I better, yep, well, I should probably, mm-hmm, you know, and you keep being there the whole time. Obviously, good afternoon is what would work.
Absolutely. And I know I said this last time that I'm a bit of a Victorian purist in the sense that they're not pure. And I find sometimes people can coddle them into thinking that they never swore, or they never had inventive slang, or they don't know what mouth kissing is. But I kind of turned my corner on the good afternoon number, because you're right. It is what he does all the time in these films and in this novella. And it's just such a good lampooning of the Olivers and all the Victorian musical numbers that feature in these kind of like gung-ho numbers, and has the best cameo, I think, of this year in cinema, halfway through the song, of the wonderful Judi Dench.
Okay, now you put me on the spot, and I am struggling to think of a better one. That's a pretty great cameo. Yeah. Oh, no, now I can't. No, well, I'm just going to have to agree with you. Yeah, I think that's the best cameo of the year. It's official. It's interesting. I mean, casting Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds as the leads in your musical, you know, they do have Octavia Spencer in there, who also has a good voice. I would say all of them have good voices. They all carry the songs. They all deliver them. But equally, I would say none of them are going to be troubling Broadway for the big musical roles in the near future. You know, they don't maybe have the power and the oomph of some of the big Broadway stars. So I did kind of want there to be a kind of a ringer brought in, you know, and a sort of, I don't know, Kelly O'Hara or Audra McDonald or somebody just dropped in for one big musical number in the middle.
Absolutely. You know. And the most annoying thing is that they have Patrick Page, who's like a Broadway like legend, who has this really deep velvety, chocolatey voice, and he gets cut off halfway through his song. Because he plays Marley, Jacob Marley. And I was like, oh my God, Patrick Page. He literally gets cut off. And I was like, why are we, he's the one Broadway legend here, and we're just cutting off his songs.
It's the worst piece of, you know, musical legend casting since Idina Menzel appeared in Enchanted and didn't get a song. So, you know, I feel your pain for that one. And at least, you know, credit where it's due to Scrooge, you know, Luke Evans is a singer. I mean, I believe all Welshmen are by law, but he is a very good singer. Jesse Buckley, again, a huge background in music. Johnny Flynn, of course, also a huge background in recording, as a recording artist. And Trevor Dion Nicholas, the original West End genie, in there as well, as the Ghost of Christmas Present. So it's not like they're kind of shorting themselves on musical options, I guess, in that film.
Absolutely. And I feel like Will Ferrell can somewhat carry a tune, because he did Eurovision, and I didn't think he was too bad in Eurovision.
No, not at all.
But Ryan Reynolds, I think, just couldn't. There was something too light about his voice that I was like, I need a proper villainy, like tenor number. where it's all snappy and he's all like vicious and he can actually sing, like, and it just, yeah, the musical numbers didn't work. They tried, which is all we can say for.
Yeah. And look, it's not that they're bad. It's just that they don't maybe have everything we want from a giant musical. I mean, you mentioned cynicism a couple of times, and I think that's a point worth kind of getting into a little bit, because particularly in Spirited, you're meant to have a really great contrast between Christmas Past, Will Ferrell's character, and Clint Briggs, Ryan Reynolds' character. And Ryan Reynolds is doing his kind of schmarmy, super smooth kind of thing that he sometimes does, and he does very, very well, and it's very funny. But Will Ferrell seemed to be really a little bit torn between genuine, like, full-on sincerity and not wanting to go full elf. And that, I think, maybe made a difficult road for him to travel. There isn't an elf joke. There was somebody in a costume at one point, but it seemed like he was a bit worried about going too elf.
I think so. And I think it's definitely a hindrance to his character, because I feel like if he went not entirely full elf, like, you never go full elf, like 90% elf, because then the contrast between his character reveal would have been a lot more shocking and alarming, when you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense why he's going so much in the other direction, versus like the somewhat cynicism he has now when he makes a few jokes that just don't really land properly. And you're like, if you make him so Christmas, it would have just made that reveal even more shocking.
Yeah. So just, I mean, because we are spoiling things, the reveal is that the Ghost of Christmas Past is Scrooge, or was Ebenezer Scrooge, and has become this essentially ambassador for Christmas spirit now, and someone who has presumably for the last, what, 170 odd years been essentially saving souls for himself, which is a lovely idea. I thought that was a really solid premise, but as you say, maybe a little bit confused in the execution, and because of that, let's talk about the look of both films. I mean, Spirited, obviously hyper modern, I think quite big budgets. You have the contrast between the kind of ghosts, rather steampunk-ish kind of slightly older world, and then you have, you know, the hyper rich kids world of Ryan Reynolds.
I really love the afterlife. I think that's the pluses for Spirited. And I kind of do like the intern that comes in and is all like, why is everyone singing? It's like the afterlife's a musical. Because I would love that. If the afterlife was truly a musical, I would absolutely go nuts for it. I just think that they also made Clint Briggs' world a little bit too glossy and too shiny. It just doesn't. I don't know, it doesn't feel right fitting into Scrooge, because Scrooge world is very like miserable and very like cynical, and last all we spoke about Scrooged and how Scrooge really captures that kind of like dreariness of Scrooge's miserable world, and actually Clint's world seems quite good and quite lovely and quite high tech
comparison.
Yeah,
because it's very kind of, you know, he's got an entire window wall overlooking a city. He's got kind of soft furnishings, white furniture, and very pale kind of a house. And yes, it's big and empty, and you can make that Scrooge comparison. But the Scrooge of Dickens' original book, and he goes on about this quite a lot, is not just a miser towards everyone else. He's also a miser towards himself. Like, he won't even spend his money on himself. And so, you know, Scrooged, the Bill Murray classic of the 1980s, you know, Scrooge's office is big and dark and gloomy, and it is impressive in inverted commas. It is something that a successful executive might consider, you know, exhibit success, but equally it's not nice, it's not desirable, it's not homey. Whereas I think Ryan Reynolds' house here, if somebody gave that to me, I'd be in it like a shot, right? I mean, that is a hell of a flat.
Oh, it was so lush and so gorgeous. And I'd be in that office. I would, you know what? I'd have no guilt. Octavia Spencer has a lot of guilt for her window office room. And I'd be like, do you know what? I'd be fine.
Just settle in.
Settle in.
Yeah. What about Scrooge then? Because the look of this, I don't personally love this style of animation. I think it was done on a bit of a budget, and no disrespect, films are. And I think to some extent they've worked with what they have. But more than that, you know, occasional moments of maybe jerkiness or less than peak smoothness. What got me was it's very clean, it's very bright, it's very colourful. And I wanted a bit more murk for my Victorian London.
I 100% agree. I think we've sort of sanitised what Victorian London looks like because of Christmas. And we're like, oh, it was snow covered. It had like toys in the window and Christmas decorations and everyone was cheery and jolly. And it's like, well, that actually wasn't the case. One of the reasons why Christmas Carol is so resonant is because they, despite having poverty and murk and dirt and grime and the smog of the Industrial Revolution and all this like disease and poor people basically freezing on the streets, is that people still celebrated Christmas in their own way. They still like worked in it. And I think the only film that's really grappled this correctly is probably The Muppets Christmas Carol, because they have that scene and it all is all dark and gloomy and people do live in their little humble homes and the mice in the little wall, but they still celebrate Christmas because that's what Christmas means. It's not about lavishness and toys and like and buying things. It's about spending time with your loved ones.
Yeah, it's weird to me that we're saying be less colorful like the Muppets are, but that is where we are at here in this podcast.
100%. They nailed it. They're felt coloured characters, but man, did they nail Victorian London grime.
And it's a devil to get off felt as well. It really is. Well, listen, it's not just us going on about A Christmas Carol, because I do want to bring in a fundamentally expert Dickens expert. Like he you know, knows everything there is to know. Paul Graham is the General Secretary of the Dickens Fellowship. So I got in touch with them to ask about what it is about A Christmas Carol in particular that means we see multiple adaptations of it pretty much every single year, even 170 something years after it was first written. So here is Paul Graham talking about Dickens. Tell me, first of all, then, I guess, about the Dickens Fellowship, about the enduring appeal of Charles Dickens, more than 100, what, nearly 150 years after his death now.
Yeah. Well, it was founded in 1902 by enthusiasts in London. And they met at a hotel one October in 1902, hoping to attract 20, perhaps 30 people. They advertised in papers trying to get a crowd. And the hotel was just flooded with people. And this is long before Dickens became an academic subject, before it became someone who was studied at schools or universities. So really, it was just enthusiasts, but a lot of them were very knowledgeable. And soon there were people outside London wanting to join. So the structure was established with branches. So currently we've got about 50 branches. The majority country is the USA, not surprisingly, perhaps. And the UK, it's largely English-speaking countries, so Australia, Canada, this country, America. But we do have some branches in non-native-speaking countries. So we've got one in Italy, one in Japan, one in France. So, yeah, and they're sort of autonomous. They do their own thing. But really, we come together annually at a conference we hold all over the world. We've been to In recent years, we've been to Carrara in Italy, Sydney in Australia, Boulogne in France. And this year, we're trying to break the spell of COVID and have it in London.
Oh, fingers crossed. That's awesome. Yeah. So what is it about Dickens that makes him so popular so long after his death? Because other writers of the period who were at least rivals to him in popularity at the time have more or less vanished, and yet he remains this sort of hardy perennial.
Yeah, I think it's, well, obviously he was incredibly productive. So we got 15 novels, we got a vast amount of journalism. A lot of the journalism stands up today. A lot of it's about contemporary events, but it does stand up. It's so well written and it's still relevant today, which is where the Christmas Carol comes in, I think, really. He was an astonishingly active letter writer. I mean, his letters were collected together in 12 very large volumes wow. by Oxford University Press, and new old letters still keep cropping up. So, you know, letters still keep appearing. So there has to be The Dickens Fellowship publish the letters that have been found that have come to light since the 12-volume edition was completed. So we put them on our website. He was active in social affairs and political affairs. He campaigned to improve the lot of the working class and of children. Again, comes across in the Carol. In this country, he travelled widely. He was a sort of a man who didn't really look backwards. He was looking forwards, looking to his own time, but to the future as well. He was just so incredibly active. The readings, he was quite a brilliant actor. He was a brilliant conjurer. He was a magician. So, there was so many facets of him. A public speaker, just multifaceted and so active. And very humorous as well.
Very funny, yeah. I didn't know about the magician side of him, I must say. Yeah, that's fascinating.
He actually bought the stock of a retiring magician and performed as an amateur at sort of children's and adult parties, 12th night parties, birthday parties. Oh. And he even, an arch misery, like Jane Carlyle, who was Thomas Carlyle's wife, said she'd been seen several professional magicians and none of them was as good as Dickens. So I think anything he turned his hand to, even hypnotism, he became a hypnotist and he tried to help people who had what we would recall, I guess, sort of mental health issues. He tried to help them through mesmerism, as it was called then. So yeah, a jack of all trades, but the master of most of them, it seems. Yeah.
Wow. A lot of that, I guess, comes from, you know, being a bit of a showman. If you're a bit of a showman, you can, and a storyteller, you can probably deliver the magic tricks better than most.
He was never a willing lieutenant, I think. He always wanted to, to be the commanding officer. And he always wanted to be, if anyone did anything, he wanted to do it better, which is, the acting, the speechifying, everything. He wanted to be the best. And often he was pretty damn good.
Yeah. So let's talk about A Christmas Carol, because I know that it was going to be, he was I think asked and certainly inspired to write about the plight of poor children, and he was going to do a pamphlet and he was going to do a fairly straight sort of, guys, we need to help the kids here, save the children, if you will, and instead he sort of delays for a little bit and then he says, hang on guys, I've got a better idea, I'm going to do something else, just wait until the end of the year. So it came from a specific point of view, I guess, and a specific aim, perhaps.
Yes. The Carol's endurance really is remarkable, given that it was written specifically for the current times, the times he was living in. He had a friend called Dr. Southwood Smith who produced this report on child employment, where, very, very young children were doing horrible, demanding works, working down mines and working in factories, very, very long hours, getting injured. And he thought initially he'd produce a pamphlet, but he realised that a pamphlet would go the way of all pamphlets. It'd be filed away and nothing would be done. So he gave a talk to the Manchester Athenaeum. And while he was in Manchester, he saw, the poverty happening there and the children working in factories there, the very long hours. And he came up with this idea of actually writing a fiction that would be more effective, more appealing, would get a far wider spread than any political pamphlet would. That was really the genesis of A Christmas Carol.
And he developed the story. I mean, there's all sorts of, I've only been researching this for a couple of days and I wanted to reread the story as well. But there's all these conflicting accounts of, oh, he was inspired by this. No, he was inspired by my neighbour. But he certainly developed the story, taking long walks around London and just thinking to himself basically at night. Is that correct?
Yeah. He wrote it very, very quickly because, bear in mind, he was writing simultaneously Martin Chuzzlewit, which was appearing serially. So that had to be done. That was his priority because he was committed to that. Whereas Christmas Carol, he had to really try and twist the arms of his publishers because people just didn't write really one-off Christmas stories. And Chapman and Hall weren't convinced that this would be a seller. So he had to convince them that it would be a good idea. And as a child, he was very imaginative, and he was. I think the idea of producing something that had the the supernatural element, the contemporary element, the sort of the practical Christian element, the humorous element. It just all came together over a relatively short period. I mean, it's staggering that it was published on the 19th of December. I mean, that just seems ridiculously close to Christmas to sell as a Christmas book. But the first edition of 6,000 sold out before Christmas Day. So clearly, you know, word of mouth and very good reviews led to its sale. But anyway, it was written incredibly quickly.
Yeah. It's really fascinating to me that, you know, nowadays when people are publishing books for Christmas, they are probably delivered by about February and they're on shelves by September, yeah. You know. So that the sheer speed of it is kind of astonishing.
Yeah.
But what is it about this book that was so radical? Because his publishers were dead wrong, weren't they? I mean, it's never been out of print since ever.
Yes.
So what is it about this story that stood out so much?
I think it's a mixture. It's a mixture of fairy tale. There's definitely a sort of a fairy tale element there. There's a mixture of sort of, morality, the morality of just being a bit kinder to people at Christmas. There is an underlying, I think, Christian element. Sort of, Dickens was sort of a New Testament Christian without having any strong affiliations to any particular sect. There's the humour, and of course there's, as always, the child in trouble, a child who will either live or die, and it depends upon, you know, one man's choice whether that child will live or die, which in an age of, you know, child mortality being as high as it was, and there was the age of trying to resolve the contemporary political and economic conditions. It was the Hungry 40s, Chartism. It was the age of Chartism, with people trying to campaign for better conditions, for political rights. So and this was sort of a political work without being overtly political. I mean, Dickens' subsequent Christmas story, The Chimes, which appeared the following year, was criticised for being sort of too overtly socialist in a way, whereas it was very deft in A Christmas Carol. The message was there, but it wasn't. You know, he talked about delivering a sledgehammer blow on behalf of the poor, but it was very deft. It was very subtle. It wasn't hammering people over the head with "look, put the poor need help." It was a lot more subtle than that. So, and I think that's, you know, it's appealed to people. I mean, in a way, it's a children's story, but in a way, it's an adult. It's a very adult story too. It appeals to all ages, I think, and. It was so popular when it first appeared. The first edition sold out very quickly. And by February the following year, there were 8 theatrical productions in London alone of A Christmas Carol. It just caught the public imagination, and it didn't seem to threaten anyone. It was just appeared to be saying, just be kind, just be good, just think of other people.
I mean, well, you bring up the adaptations that appeared immediately, which brings me neatly on to sort of the subject of the podcast, which is Christmas movies, because this year it is the 30th anniversary of Muppet's Christmas Carol, yeah. Which, God help me, I don't know what Dickens would have thought of that, but it's much more faithful than some, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
And we also have 2 new adaptations, Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, which is on Netflix, and Spirited, which is a musical sort of update, continuation almost of the story on Apple Plus. So it just feels like it's still everywhere. It is still one of the sort of definitive Christmas stories that people keep going back to.
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think that in a way is probably the reason why it's popularity, that people who've never actually read it know the story, because if they've not seen it on television, if not seen Scrooge McDuck, for instance, or do you say the Muppets, let alone the great Alistair Sim performance, or George C. Scott, they'll have probably seen a cartoon version, they'll have heard it on the radio, they'll have seen a television production. It's everywhere. It seems to be nowadays a sort of an equivalent to a pantomime, because it's on at so many theatres. I mean, the RSC, it's on at the Old Vic again. I mean, it's on at the Old Vic every Christmas for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm going to see one in above a pub in Turnham Green. Everyone does it. I think so many actors want to either do it as Dickens adapted it for a reading, or to play Scrooge, because it's a great part, and it's you know, the idea of redemption, the Christian idea of redemption is certainly there. But it's hard to escape even if you don't read the book, which of course was true in Dickens's day, because when he wrote it, and it was he insisted on such lavish production values with the illustrations, which were hand coloured, the gilt, you know, the binding, everything was beautiful. It cost 5 shillings. Well, you know, Bob Cratchit in A Christmas Carol, he gets 15 shillings a week, so that's a third of his you know, weekly pay on one single book. So a lot of people didn't actually, you know, the poor, the working class, probably couldn't afford it, but it could be read to them. They could buy one of the many very, very cheap pirated works, because it was pirated immediately. People were producing very cheap, very nasty subtext versions of A Christmas Carol. So the story, you know, became famous without people having actually to read it.
Yes. I want to ask about some of the adaptations. So, I mean, because it has been adapted as long as there have been movies. I think 1901 was the first British effort. But the Alistair Sims one you mentioned, which I think is that 1951, is often cited as the one that is sort of definitive. Where do you stand on that one?
Yeah, I love that. It's not, doesn't strictly stick to the story as in the text, but I think it is brilliant. I think any adaptation does probably have to crop something. I mean, you never see you rarely see in an adaptation, put it that way, scenes where Scrooge is taken in the air and over land and sea to see, you know, people singing Christmas carols in lighthouses, people in mines, etc. But I think Alistair Sim is probably my favourite. I've never seen The Muppets, but people who have seen it do tell me that it's as you say, it's the most faithful reproduction of the lot.
I don't know about most faithful, but it does lift entire blocks of dialogue. It has Michael Caine obviously playing Scrooge,
yes,
dead straight, and then he's just surrounded by Muppets. You know, all the characters, like, you know, Bob Cratchit is still a well-meaning guy. He just happens to be a frog. Mrs. Cratchit is still prone to outrage against, you know, Scrooge, but she just happens to be also Miss Piggy. Yes. You know, so you have all of these kind of layers. And I have to say, the ghosts are pretty much exactly as described in the books, which, because I had read it as a child, I'd seen The Muppets as a child, but I hadn't sort of put them together until this year. But, you know, the Ghost of Christmas Past is the closest I think I've seen on screen to what's described in the book.
Yes. Well, I think the idea of getting the scary elements right, I mean, obviously a lot of children go to see it at the theatre, but getting the scary elements right, children, I don't think, don't mind too much being a bit scared, and then getting, you know, the humour right, and getting, you know, the overriding moral of the tale right. I mean, that's asking quite a lot. But, you know, I'm so to say, I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment upon it. But people do tell me that it's a very good adaptation. I think the George C. Scott one was quite dark, and of course, with the television version last year, which was even darker. I mean, most theatrical productions I've seen recently like to delve into the backstory of Scrooge. How did Scrooge get to be as he is? It's hinted at in the text, but a lot of people try to make it explicit on stage about his upbringing, his father mistreating him, that sort of thing. So, which is fine. I mean, if people want to, you know, people have messed around with the story to some extent ever since it was, you know, since 1843, which is fine. It hasn't done it any harm, I don't think.
Have you seen Scrooged, the one with Bill Murray in the sort of 1980s?
I haven't seen it right through. I've seen bits of it. I mean, it's not really my thing, but you can't be too precious about these things. I mean, it's a sort of homage, which is fine.
Yeah.
Although it was written specifically for that time and that situation in England in 1843, its message is still relevant, and if it needs adaptation and people think that you know helps the relevance, then I've no problem with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, like it feels like it has informed whole genres of Christmas movies that don't directly take the story. They don't have three ghosts. They don't have a Scrooge, if you will, but they have something of that tone. You know, I'm thinking of something like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, yes, one of the definitive Christmas movies, but it has that same kind of darkness and melancholy.
Yes.
That then allows the kind of release and you know joy of the Christmas scenes at the end, because it's kind of it's counterbalanced them almost.
Yeah, so it's the element of redemption, and redemption coming through that particular season, even in an age where, as we found out yesterday, that you know, the majority of people in the country may not say they're Christians anymore, but it is a sort of the Christian message of redemption, and things look darker before the dawn, that sort of thing. So yeah. Perhaps without knowing it, Dickens hit a theme which is just universal for all times, for all people.
Absolutely. Just to finish up, I mean, you mentioned already, and I know as well from just my reading, that he wrote other Christmas stories.
Yes.
You know, where do you think they sort of fell short of this, or did they? You know, maybe they're just as good, and they just haven't been quite as well known.
They definitely fell short. Yes. I mean, apart from one other, which is The Haunted Man, which is the last one he wrote, which I think is the second best of his Christmas stories, none of the others relate to Christmas at all, apart from the fact that they were published for the Christmas market. The Haunted Man is published, does refer to Christmas. It's Christmas time, and it's about a man who's sad and morose and who's been disappointed in love, really, and wants to forget that he was betrayed by his best friend with his fiance, and he wants his memory to be erased. But then I think the message is that we need our memories, good, bad, indifferent. They all help to make us what we are. So I think that was the second best. The Chimes succeeded A Christmas Carol, and that's more overtly political. It's more of its time. It features characters who you could identify as political characters of that year. And that really was criticised for its more overt political message. And the ones in between, The Chimes and The Haunted Man, probably the best, the least said, the better, really.
Fair enough. But people stick to, and actually go back and read A Christmas Carol, they're still onto a winner, I think.
Yeah, I know people who read it annually, and I can understand it, because, it's not like Bleak House of Dombey and Son. It's very short. You can read it in a night or a couple of nights, and I think it still delivers. It still delivers.
Yeah, it does. Well, Paul Graham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Helen.
And I'm Kobe.
And we're from FlixWatcher, a podcast in the Strip Media family.
We are a movie podcast, and we review films that are just on Netflix in the UK.
So if you've ever struggled to find a film on Netflix to watch, we're the podcast for you.
We have guests on from other podcasts, big and small, just like these guys that you listen to now. They choose the films, and we rate them and discuss them with our unique scoring system.
You can find FlixWatcher on any podcast app by searching FlixWatcher. That's F-L-I-X Watcher.
And if you want more information about any of the other podcasts in the Strip Media family, just visit www.stripped.media to find out more.
All right, and that was Paul Graham of the Dickens Fellowship. So yeah, it is amazing, right, isn't it? We're talking about two quite big budget releases, same year, of essentially A Christmas Carol, and it's still with us. What is it? Is it that, as the Dan Stevens film a couple of years ago said, Dickens is the man who invented Christmas, that to some degree you can't have a lot of this without Dickens and maybe the Victorians more widely? What is it about this story that we keep coming back to?
I think everyone wants the worst person in the world to get visited by free ghosts and change their ways. There was an amazing joke about Jeff Bezos, and he gave up a lot of his money recently towards charity, and someone basically went, he's been visited by free ghosts. And I think that's the kind of energy that I, what Spirited, I suppose, grasped correctly, is that no one is irredeemable. No one, and everyone has a chance to come back and turn their lives around. And I guess that is still a message that warms our hearts, that Christmas can bring out the best in people and remind people of what makes Christmas and love and hope so magical and so like spellbinding. And I guess that's kind of resonant for however centuries and decades we've had this story.
I think that's right. And I think it's such a well-crafted portrait as well of someone coming to terms with their own faults, you know. So Scrooge is literally toured through the things that made him the way he is and forced to confront them, but also forced to confront the effect that that has had on other people and the ways that he has not only been hurt, but also hurt others. And I think you begin to see, you know, like it sort of makes psychological sense the way that he opens up in that story. It's very carefully crafted, I think, in that sense. I don't know. I mean, even Dickens, when he wrote several more Christmas stories, didn't quite recapture the same magic. There's something about that combination of miserliness and joy that particularly works.
Absolutely. It's like the world's greatest free therapy session for Scrooge.
It really is. He's basically on the ghost's couch, isn't he? Tell me about your parents, you know, or at least your school days. And it is clear that he's been through the war at Scrooge. Like, he hasn't had it easy. You know, he's clearly had a very unhappy childhood, very, very difficult family circumstances that have made him into this miser and made him into this misery guts. But equally, as the story and these films all tell us, it's ultimately not an excuse. You still need to try and be a good person.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important message, that one of the biggest takeaways, what I love Spirited did touch upon this is that, like, how did you know that Ebenezer has really changed? And I quite like the fact that the novella ends that he was true to his word, and he kept trying, and he kept the message of Christmas all year long. And it's all about, that's the big takeaway, is it's not just about Christmas. It's about taking that and doing it day in, day, and proving to yourself and proving to people around you that you care and you love them and helping out. And that's why it's just such a great story.
Mm, it is. And even if these aren't the very peak of A Christmas Carol adaptations, as we've discussed, they do essentially both still offer something for us this Christmas. So if you are into, you know, Ryan Reynolds comedy in particular, great songs about afternoons, you know, Spirited is probably the one for you. And look, hey, I'm not, no judgment. If your kink is hot Scrooge, then Scrooge A Christmas Carol.
Scrooge A Christmas Carol. And join me on hot Ebenezer Scrooge talk, because it's very, there's a fan base there.
I dread to think what the ghosts are doing to him on hot Ebenezer Scrooge talk, frankly. I don't even tell me. I don't want to know. I should also mention, by the way, my favourite cameo. I recognise that, you know, Dame Judy is pretty unimpeachable, but my favourite throwaway joke in Spirited is actually when they're in the Hall of the Redeemed, all these people who have been saved by the ghosts, and one of the people on the wall is Dolly Parton. I just love that for us. I think it's hilarious because if you're making a list of great people in the world who have done good things with their power and their money and their fame, 100% Dolly Parton should be up there. We did discuss her Christmas on the Square, Christmas movie, a couple of years back, and perhaps it's best to draw a veil over some of its quality issues. However, she has done enormous amounts to, you know, raise money and you know, give books to children and give to charity, develop COVID vaccines, for God's sake. It absolutely makes sense to me that she was at one point visited by three ghosts and became one of the greatest.
Absolutely. And how, you know, she wrote 9 to 5. I like to think that's her turning point.
Okay, well, there's a lot to unpack there. Just one thing that we haven't discussed that we did in the original, and I cannot stress this enough, greatest podcast ever recorded that we lost. But You talked to me a little bit about Victorian slang, and I think people need to hear this from you. Please tell me about your favourite bits of Victorian slang.
Oh, absolutely. I have three favourites that I use quite often. One of them is arf, arf, and arf, which means you've had too many arfs and you're quite drunk. So if you ever feel like bringing that in over Christmas period as well, oh, granddads.
So arf, how would one use that in a sentence? It's like you've had arf, arf, and arf.
Yeah, or like granddad's a bit arf, arf, and arf.
Oh, okay. Useful. Yeah.
Exactly. Temporary melancholia is got the morbs.
Morbs. Which, so like I watched Morbius and then I got the morbs might be a sentence you could use that in.
Absolutely perfect. Yeah, absolutely. Works so well. But my ultimate favourite is a perfect woman, which they had a lot of slang for perfect women, but the best one is the jammiest bit of jam.
The jammiest bit of jam. Well, I mean, that is a perfect note to end on because thank you, Sarah Cook, the very jammiest bit of jam. It's been an absolute pleasure and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.